Ian Dunt, you haven't been in a cave, you've been in the windswept wilds of Scotland.
I have, because, well, it doesn't feel like an entirely moral thing to be going on holidays, although we sort of kind of can to certain places. So it's mostly sort of being stuck in the mist and the rain and the cold, but in a different location to the place that I lived. And that's what constituted my summer holidays this year.
Well, you must feel very proud as an honorary Australian that we've saved Britain from financial ruin, that Scott Morrison has done a deal with Boris.
Yes, no, thank heavens for that. The deal is projected to sort of increase the size of the UK economy by 0.02% over 15 years. So I think, you know, that alone would definitely make up for the long run loss of output of 4% that we had from the EU. We haven't actually seen this deal yet, but I think if I was Australian, I'd feel pretty confident about having come out of it on top. I mean, the details that we are looking at would suggest that we're seeing quite concrete ideas of what Australia has gained. So, for instance, there's a bit of a delay during which point we have sort of tariff-free for quotas for when sort of certain items like beef and lamb come in. But even during that period of delay, you know, you've got tariff-free quotas of 35,000 tonnes for beef. Now, consider for a moment the fact that in 2019, Britain imported about 1,700 tonnes of beef from Australia. It doesn't seem like these restrictions will be particularly severe. And I think the reason for that is ultimately a sort of strategic approach to negotiation. You know, Britain is going around the world. This is the first trade deal it's got from scratch. It's going around the world with an evident, demonstrable, urgent political need for trade deals. And most trade partners, no matter how friendly they are the rest of the time, you know, trade partnership is not the place where everyone has a group hug. It's where you fight for your country's interests. Most trade partners look at that and think, well, we can take them to the table. And my initial impressions, we haven't seen the document, but from what we have seen, is that that's pretty much what Australia has done.
Well, you see, I am a beef producer, so I'm thrilled by this. And I'm going to make sure that you, Ian Dunt, get to munch on an Elmswood steak at some point. What sort of an effect did Scott Morrison have on the Richter scale of political life in London apart from that?
Well, we noticed he's got himself into the spot of bother with the Cornwall trip that he had while he was around back at home. He doesn't really cut through, actually. I mean, I would have thought probably maybe 5% of the British public would be aware who he is. I could be wrong about that, but you know, you never take too much of a risk overestimating the ignorance of the British public when it comes to international affairs. Insofar as he is sort of recognised, I think it's really as this sort of hapless, God-bothering charisma vacuum with authoritarian tendencies and a kind of Neanderthal view of climate change. And this is not, I mean, you...
I'm gobsmacked that you would come on this programme and say things like that about my beloved Prime Minister. I mean, it's all right to attack Boris, but leave Scott alone. Now, incidentally, Boris did the right thing. He snuck him into a meeting with Joe.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we don't have too much information. I mean, we do know, you know, on the environment at this stage, you know, Boris Johnson and Joe Biden are on the same page. That's not what we see from Morrison, although it looks like he might be able to wriggle his way out of it. I have to say, this is early stage stuff. I don't have any trust in Boris Johnson's commitment to this environmental project when you get to the business end of things and you actually have to charge people more money for energy, you know, more money for fuel. That's when things get politically difficult, when you're coming up with a sort of top-level goals that are going to be implemented ultimately by a successor. It's rather easier. They do also share, I think, all three of them really, this view on China, of China as this quite severe, now approaching an existential threat that has to be tackled quite roughly. That is also the view of many, many Tory MPs, most of them Brexiters, oddly enough, but on this issue, I think probably largely quite sound. So, I mean, there's some areas where there's a meeting of minds there and some areas like the environment where it's a bit more difficult.
Ian, let me raise the subject of a recent by-election, Amersham.
Yeah, Chesham and Amersham, fascinating seat here. You may remember a little while back in Hartlepool, Labour was losing all of its original supporters. This is sort of northern post-industrial towns. Going over to the Conservatives, this is the great realignment of British politics, typically school leavers versus graduates Nationalist voters versus internationalist voters, leavers versus remainers, the cultural realignment. Now, the Tories so far have done very well by just solidifying a very core vote of socially conservative nationalist school leave voters. However, there is a price for this. And the price really is in the south, where there are many suburban areas where you've got graduates moving out of the cities like London, typically priced out. You know, they have kids, they want to go somewhere where they can have a better quality of life. And they're changing the political shade of these suburbs. These are also former, you know, quite liberal voters. They might vote Lib Dem, Liberal Democrat. They might vote Conservative. They are alienated by the kind of nationalist politics that they see from Boris Johnson. Now, in the last election, they stayed with the Tories because they thought Jeremy Corbyn was more of a threat. They really couldn't stand the idea of him. He is now gone. And we have Keir Starmer as Labour. So many of those voters are more prepared to lend their vote to the Lib Dems. This is because they're kind of concerned about a situation where there might be a Lib Dem-Labour coalition at the end of it. Now, for the first time, we've seen that consequence now. It's a massive swing from the Conservatives to the Liberal Democrats in Chesham and Emerson of 25 points. The first time this seat has gone Tory since 1974 when it was created. Now, there are a lot of seats for the Tories that are vulnerable in seats just like that, where the culture war that they have decided to fight works against them. And some of those seats are held by very prominent figures. Dominic Raab, Jeremy Hunt, Michael Gove, some of the key architects of this government are suddenly looking at their own constituency and thinking, hang on a minute, I might be vulnerable.
But Labour isn't picking up the votes. It's going to the Lib Dems.
Yeah, the thing is, there's the seats that can go against the Tories are often split between Lib Dems and Labour. And typically speaking, where there's a bit more deprivation, where things are a bit rougher, it's Labour that is the main contender against the Tories. In other seats, like Amersham, like Winchester, like Wimbledon, these sort of more affluent, more bourgeois, liberal-minded seats, typically it's the Liberal Democrats who are seen as less radical that can take on the Tories. Amersham was certainly one of those. Soon we're going to see the results of the Batley and Spen by-election, where it looks like Labour might be having trouble. So none of this means that the Tories are on their last legs, far from it. It just sort of shows that if you follow a culture war narrative in government, there is a cost to it, not only gains from Boris Johnson's perspective.
Ian, I'd like you to tell me about the wondrously christened Edwin Poots.
Edwin Poots, yes. The leader of the DUP, or rather he was, his leadership of the DUP lasted precisely 1 week longer than my holidays. I was away for 2 weeks, and his leadership lasted for 3 weeks. He is a creation. I mean, the man is completely off the scale. He's a sort of creationist, believes the Earth is about 6,000 years old, somehow found himself the leadership of the Ulster Unionists. Now, this party in Northern Ireland probably had the worst Brexit of anyone. And given how many people had a terrible Brexit, that's quite impressive. They campaigned for Brexit. They supported Boris Johnson. They supported Theresa May. They vociferously attacked the opponents of Brexit. Where what it ended up getting them was a customs border between the British mainland and Northern Ireland, essentially an existential threat to their entire political project. And in fact, their life's work, their core political values. That has sent the party into spasms of apoplectic fear and anxiety. They got rid of Arlene Forster, who was the leader before. I mean, she wasn't very good, but she wasn't entirely responsible for what was taking place. Put in Edwin Poots, got rid of him after 21 days. It now looks like we'll be getting someone else in. We have no idea how long they're going to last. The party is in an absolute state.
Back to Boris, who's promised to fix the crisis in social care, which isn't quite the same thing as the NHS.
No, well, social care is, you know, usually when people get a bit older, you know, they have to go into a care home. I mean, at the moment in Britain, that costs a huge amount of money. It basically shrivels up any savings people really had, and the system doesn't work very well. All parties know this has to be fixed. Whenever they come up with a plan for doing it, the whole thing falls apart. Now, Boris Johnson stood outside of Downing Street in July 2019 and said, quote, that he had a clear plan we have prepared. That was the quote, which is a strange thing to consider, given that right now they admit that they have no plan. There was supposed to be a meeting on this week, which was cancelled at the last minute. They can't really seem to get their hands around it. And the reason they can't get their hands around it goes to something quite core about the Conservatives at the moment. And that's that when you get away from the culture war stuff and the talk about statues and wokeness and all of that and Brexit and get down to the economic agenda that they have, where they have promised post-industrial towns, they're going to level up, you know, easier to get a high-paying job. You won't have to leave your town in order to succeed in life, cheaper housing. Suddenly, they face a problem, which is that they are fundamentally conservatives. You know, these are fiscal hawks. They don't want to spend a lot of money. They don't want to raise income tax. They don't want to raise VAT. They don't want to raise national insurance. They can't afford to go raiding the pension pot because most of their supporters are predominantly pensioners who will turn against them if they do. So suddenly, when they're presented with the promises that they made, they come back to that very old right-wing problem of the fact they don't want to spend any money. And at the moment, that is finally, after sort of a couple of years, starting to cause them real political damage.
I heard you utter the word wokeness, so let's spend some time on the terms wokeness and capitalism, because they're going to be interpreted for a British think tank too soon. Tell me about this.
Yeah, John Luntz, this sort of Republican pollster, he came up with the phrase climate change rather than global warming, if you remember, because he thought global warming suggested we were facing some kind of existential threat, whereas climate change was something that you didn't need to worry about so much, which is a funny form of reasoning to take, given that that is precisely what it does constitute. Is now worried about the phrase capitalism. He thinks that that's sort of now sounds like an evil word. And he is talking a lot in the UK about this idea of, you know, well, you've got the word populist, which we refer to as, you know, again, these sort of forgotten post-industrial towns. You've got the word wokeness, which is supposed to be sort of young people, people from different ethnic backgrounds, different sexualities, different genders who are fighting for recognition. And everyone's sort of got a point, but if you don't stop this, then we're going to end up in a third world war. He has a very loose grasp of these terms. Wokeness itself has really degenerated into a term with almost no meaning whatsoever. It used to be used by people pursuing essentially left-wing identity politics on the basis of race, on the basis of sexuality and gender. Now it is used exclusively, and I really do mean exclusively. I haven't heard anyone, any of its advocates use it for a very long time. It's used really by the government as part of that same culture war, saying it's the anti-woke government fighting wokeness in universities, fighting it, you know, in protests, Black Lives Matter, and all of that. So the word itself isn't useful, but when you pull back, the reality of our political situation now does sort of bear some similarity to what he's saying. We have identity warriors on the right pursuing Brexit, pursuing the anti-woke brigade. We have identity warriors on the left on the basis of race and gender. And there is almost no one who is actually talking about what individuals have in politics and the manner in which they can have a transactional, beneficial relationship with politics which progresses social rules rather than the sort of war of who you are as instead of what you want.
Well, I think your break has done you the world of good. Good on you, Ian Dunt, editor at large of politics.co.uk.